From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And this is Helen Caldicott. On September 11th, America went to the highest state of nuclear alert, DEFCON 2, before George Bush got to press the button. They stayed probably for several weeks on that. Russia has 2,500 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert, and so does America. 1,000 would produce the end of all life on Earth through nuclear winter. This is the foundation upon which the fragile international situation now depends, whether or not we continue life on Earth.
The new nuclear danger, George W. Bush's military-industrial complex. But first, was Washington behind the failed military coup in Venezuela? The White House says no. Recent revelations suggest the administration knew a lot more than it first let on. And we'll go to Jenin, refugee camp on the West Bank. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of Palestinians poured back into the demolished refugee camp of Jenin yesterday when Israeli troops briefly withdrew. Palestinians dug five survivors from the rubble. Today, a resident told Reuters he had heard many people asking for help but couldn't do anything for them because of lack of equipment. Residents are clawing through rubble with shovels, pickaxes, and their bare hands in search of people buried alive beneath buildings flattened by Israeli bulldozers. The International Committee of the Red Cross confirms it is hampered by a lack of bomb disposal and search and rescue teams. An Amnesty International spokesperson says it was contacted by a local human rights group which had received a call from a family of 10 trapped underground asking for help, but there's still no concerted effort to search for and rescue survivors. Israeli officials say military search and rescue units are at work there, but the New York Times reports none were seen. The Israeli newspaper Hatsofeh is reporting an Israeli helicopter gunship pilot refused a direct order to bomb a Palestinian house for fear of hitting civilians. The disclosure follows widespread condemnation of the use of such gunships on civilian areas. Palestinian doctors in Jenin blame a significant number of civilian casualties on the U.S.-made gunships. The claim also follows growing concern among some soldiers over the legality and effectiveness of certain actions, in particular firing on ambulances trying to recover casualties. Some soldiers have questioned such tactics. Israel said today it will withdraw from most West Bank cities by the end of the week, but said its forces would besiege Yasser Arafat's compound and Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity until Palestinians sheltering inside surrender. This news from Afghanistan. A U.S. F-16 warplane killed four Canadian soldiers, wounded eight, when it dropped one or two 500-pound laser-guided precision bombs on them. Canadian defense officials said their soldiers were on a training exercise near Kandahar. They said the area is recognized as a training area. Meanwhile, the U.S. military commander in the Afghan war, General Tommy Franks, came under fire yesterday for his conduct of the campaign. The criticism came after the Washington Post reported the Bush administration has concluded Osama bin Laden was present during the battle for Tora Bora late last year, and that failure to commit U.S. ground troops to hunt him was its gravest error in the war. The Post reported local militias, who the U.S. used as ground troops, did not seal off the mountain redoubt, and some colluded in the escape of fleeing al-Qaeda fighters. Some officials said Franks did not perceive the setback soon enough because he ran the war from Tampa, Florida, with no commander on the scene above the rank of lieutenant colonel. The first Americans did not arrive until 3 days into the fighting. The Washington Post also reported the Bush administration has never publicly acknowledged that bin Laden escaped Tora Bora as U.S. aircraft began bombing, but inside the government there's little controversy on the subject. However, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld yesterday dismissed the report as speculation. Meanwhile, President Bush said good progress has been made in destroying Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, but warned the so-called war against terrorism is far from over. In 6 months of fighting, only one senior al-Qaeda leader has been captured. You are listening to the news headlines here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go to the story on the West Bank that is dominating all others, and it is what happened in the Jenin refugee camp. We're joined on the phone right now by Philip Reed, who is a reporter with the British newspaper The Independent. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you tell us what you know at this point?
Well, we understand that there are now some efforts being made to dig bodies out of the rubble. The exact number of bodies retrieved over the last few days, the official figures have varied, but are still in the around sort of 30, 35. But another body was found today. Terje Larsen, the Middle East Special Envoy for the UN, has been there and has expressed extreme horror at the scene, which I visited a couple of days ago, and I think I might have told your audience a couple of days ago, is a truly horrific sight. And he has also pleaded for humanitarian organizations to be allowed in to get on with the recovery operation so as we know how many bodies are underneath that rubble. The fact that there are bodies there is very clear, if only from the terrible smell that is emanating from parts of the site.
And have there been any indications of any of the atrocities that have been reported in terms of what the Israelis did to Palestinians there?
Yeah, there was an autopsy carried out yesterday by a British pathologist, a professor of forensic medicine from Dundee University, who is part of an Amnesty International delegation. He found a body which had been shot in the back and in the top of the foot, which he regarded as highly unusual, arguing that if the body was shot in the back, then why would someone shoot it in the foot? And if it was shot in the foot, then why would it be shot in the back? And he feels that this points to some kind of irregular form of death. And it adds to what is a fattening dossier of allegations being made about atrocities there. Whether there was a massacre there, though, which is what the Palestinians allege, remains unclear. We do really know that there were atrocities, major atrocities. This is an attack on a densely populated civilian area, and you know, hundreds of homes have been razed to the ground, and humanitarian aid and ambulances were denied access for a long time. So that much in itself amounts to an atrocity. But the question of whether it was a massacre remains unclear at this stage.
Phil Reeves, a reporter with The Independent. We're also just joined on the line by Peter Hansen, who is the Commissioner General of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. You have just come out of the Jenin refugee camp. Can you tell us what you've seen?
I've seen the worst destruction that I had feared. I had hoped that some of the stories that were getting out were exaggerated in the light of the excitement about the whole affair. But I was with an expert who has seen dozens of earthquakes, and as a disaster expert, and said that he had never seen an earthquake that had wreaked such damage as has been wreaked upon Jenin. What is worse also is to see the scene of decomposing bodies where you can only tell by the size of the ribcage, whether it's child or grown up. We saw the remnants of a child under the rubble, and according to families there are in some houses, seven believed to be buried under the rubble, and I saw families digging for their dear ones, a family digging for their father, whom they found in small decomposed bits. It was a very gruesome sight.
And do you have any? Have you been able to tally at this point how many bodies have been confirmed to have been found?
Well, confirmed to have been found, I think is still down below the 20 mark. I'm not sure, but what I have concluded from my visit today is it'll take a very long time, if ever, before we get a full body count, because the destruction is so massive that if we have to move in with heavy equipment to clear out the rubble, it will probably not be possible to distinguish individual bodies as we dig through the rubble.
Are the Israeli Defense Forces impeding your operations at this point, or are they still in Jenin?
At this point, I must say they are not. But at virtually every other point in the whole crisis we've had here over a long time, they have been seriously impeding our work. Today we were let through. yesterday we were let through with supplies into the camp, but we had our trucks and our ambulances sitting outside the damage while it was going on, being blocked from entering and helping those who were bleeding to bring food and medicine into the camp. When we distributed food today, people were desperate to get the food and were flocking around the delivery truck in a way I do not remember having seen since scenes in Angola and other places where people have been starved.
We're talking to Peter Hansen, Commissioner General of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. We've been trying to get you for quite a long time, so we very much appreciate this call. The Commissioner General has just come out of the Jenin refugee camp. Why is the Israeli military keeping you out, making it so difficult until now to get into the camp?
Well, the easy answer would be you must ask the Israeli Defense Forces. They have given us absolutely no explanation that is credible. And we have been, quite frankly, extremely disappointed in the lack of responsiveness the Israeli army has shown this humanitarian agency as well as the International Red Cross.
And what about the people? We have reports that thousands poured back in to look for their loved ones or for the body parts of those that they believe were there. But then we read in the paper that the Israeli military came back in and started shooting into the sky, forcing people to flee.
That was yesterday. Today, they enforced the curfew again at 2 o'clock, about the time that we were leaving the camp, and I saw or heard no shooting today. We saw hundreds and hundreds of people walking around like in a daze, looking for what used to be their home, what used to be their dear ones when they were digging for them under the rubble. But with as many people walking around as we saw today and no explosions, I do not believe that the city has been as, or the camp has been as heavily mined or booby-trapped as was claimed by the Israeli army. They used that as a reason for keeping us out, saying it was too dangerous for us to get in.
And are we correct in assuming, given the amount of destruction that we've seen in some of these in some of these photographs, that there's still no electricity or running water in the refugee camp, or in what about Jenin as a whole?
There is no electricity, no running water. I don't know whether there would be individual small segments of the city that's of the town of Jenin, but certainly I tried to turn on several cabs. Perhaps in Jenin, and there was no water coming out, and we have ourselves been bringing in water for multi-purpose uses, and of course especially drinking water, which has been in extremely short supply.
Phil Reeves of The Independent is also on the line with us. You wrote a piece in the last few days, Amid the Ruins of Jenin, the Grisly Evidence of a War Crime, and you tell the story of walking with Kamal Anis and how you stared at a mound of debris, and he said he saw Israeli soldiers pile 30 bodies beneath a half-wrecked house. When the pile was complete, they bulldozed the building, bringing its ruins down on the corpses. Then they flattened the area with a tank. We could not see the bodies, but we could smell them. Could you talk more about this?
Well, there have been several accounts of mass graves and also of individual graves. And there was also an account given by an eyewitness to Amnesty International of 32 people being put into a trench grave. Obviously, at this stage, without actually having seen it with our own eyes, we could never say 100% that these things happened. But on the other hand, there are so many stories of things happening of an awful nature coming out of the camp that the balance of probability has to point in the direction that even if you accept only 10% of them, one has to accept that terrible things have occurred there. One question for Mr. Hansen, though, is they do have a list at UNRWA of 13,500 people who were registered with the camp. And this list, I think, will be absolutely crucial to finding out in the end how many people are missing. But it's unclear to many people involved in this, covering this tragedy, whether that list is actually going ever to be accurate, whether they know whether refugees who should have been in the camp have left and gone to Jordan or gone in hiding or are in detention or whatever. But without an accurate list of the number of people there, it'll be very hard to find out how many people have not made it out of this disaster.
The UN is now, Peter Hansen, Commissioner General of UNRWA, the UN Refugee and Works Agency, is now beginning a count of the residents in the camp to figure out how many people have died. Can you explain how this operation will take place?
Well, we have the refugees registered, but as it was commented a moment ago, we do not know at any one time exactly where people are, even if they're registered with UNRWA. They may be abroad, they may have moved, so we do not have up-to-date list. We are now with the International Red Cross in the process of identifying or hearing from families who they are missing. So it is only with this work we eventually will be able to come to an approximation of how many lost their lives during the last 2 weeks.
Secretary General Kofi Annan has said that the Israeli military is waging what looks like an all-out conventional war on Palestinian civilians. Can you talk more about that, Peter Hansen?
Well, he is correct in characterizing it as such. We usually think of a war as being between two sovereign entities or two opposing armies or guerrilla army, if it is. But here it is really very, very lightly armed, dispersed small groups. We are talking about fighting one of the world's mightiest military machines, and one cannot avoid the impression that it is an asymmetry in power that probably has not occurred very often in world military history, because the action is directed against the civilian population and against structures. Even UNRWA's medical center, our clinic, which I visited today in the camp, was completely sprayed over with bullets from the inside, as if it had been a machine gun shooting gallery. The aim of some of the bullets were the vaccine refrigerators, where a lot of badly needed vaccines have been simply destroyed for I don't know what reason. That certainly is against the civilian population needing medicines and vaccines that are being systematically destroyed by wild shooting. The dental chair was smashed. Oxygen tank were smashed. It is willful and wanton destruction that I have seen in that health center. That is hardly a security problem for the
And Phil Reason, in the last few seconds that we have, can you tell us whether Secretary Colin Powell's visit has had any impact on the situation there on the ground?
No, it hasn't. I think we are past the point at this stage where diplomacy is going to be effective. There's a terrible lack of faith in it by those engaged now in this conflict. The Palestinians just don't believe the Americans are capable of being impartial in this. And as Peter Hansen was just saying there, there is this sense now that what was launched in the name of a counter-terrorism operation, I mean, you have to pinch yourself to believe this, has resulted in this massive destruction. It is collective punishment, and I think people are so angry. I meet many Palestinians who've just given up on the whole thing.
Finally, Peter Hansen, Commissioner General of UNRWA, would you say what you've seen in the Jenin refugee camp constitutes war crimes?
No, despite the seriousness, I don't feel that I'm a prosecutor and I'm a judge, and I would not serve anybody any justice by jumping to such characterizations. I hope that others with a special mandate in that direction will have a chance to look into this and pass a judgment that is full and considerate and there for the world to see.
And would you say you're free to operate there now?
I was saying we got in today without being harassed or in any other way hindered today. But this is the first day for 2 weeks we have, and it is absolutely essential that the Israelis change course and allow humanitarian organizations to operate as the Israelis are obliged to, according to the international treaties they have undertaken, the Geneva Convention, etc. If we do not get freedom of movement and access, we cannot do and succeed in the enormous task awaiting us in Jenin.
Peter Hansen, Commissioner General of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, known as UNRWA, just came out of the Jenin refugee camp. And Phil Reeves, a reporter with the British newspaper, The Independent. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, was the White House behind the failed military coup in Venezuela? Then Dr. Helen Caldicott will join us, talking about the nuclear threat and Bush's military-industrial complex. Stay with us.
Today, the president has turned to direct, overt military force.
One evening at about midnight, while they were sleeping, they heard some loud noises outside. Their area was being bombed. Some of them were wounded by rockets.
We are a world at war.
We're speaking against the war not because anybody is going to listen, but we're speaking against the war for us to retain our faith in ourselves as human beings.
Help turn the tide towards peace. Join us for a six-hour live coast-to-coast program on the burgeoning mobilization for peace. Tune in to Perspectives on Peace this Saturday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on your local Pacifica station.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, you did an important piece today in the New York Daily News about Venezuela and the coup. And this is a story that we will continue to hear unfold. What do we know so far?
Well, you know, Washington's story on its role in last week's coup in Venezuela keeps on changing. On Monday, senior administration officials admitted that they met several times with coup leaders and were briefed on the situation in advance. A Defense Department official said, quote, "We're not discouraging people. We were not discouraging people. We were sending informal, subtle signals that we don't like Chavez." But they've also said, though, that they urged those who were those opponents with whom they met not to engage in a military coup. A State Department official initially said that Otto Reich, the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, had phoned Pedro Carmona, the Venezuelan person installed as president by the Venezuelan military. But then that story changed yesterday when the State Department announced that it was not Reich that placed the call, but the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, Charles Shapiro, at Reich's request. For those who don't recall past political scandals in the United States, Otto Reich was a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal. He was, at the time, operating as part of former CIA Director Bill Casey and Ali North's enterprise within the U.S. government and funneling money to organizations that then engaged in money laundering and gun running for the Contras in Nicaragua. So he has a past that has that tends to go in the direction of covert operations. And as a result, the Senate has refused to confirm him in his position as Assistant Secretary of State. He's actually a recess appointee right now of President Bush because the Senate has refused to confirm him. So we're joined today by Greg Pallas, the reporter for BBC Television Newsnight and the author of The Best Money Democracy Can Buy, who it joins us to talk a little bit about what he knows about the Venezuelan situation. And we're also going to have with us Bob Parry, the former correspondent for the Associated Press and Newsweek, who reported on the Iran-Contra scandal about 2 decades ago.
That's right. His latest book is Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, the Press, and Project Truth. Bob Parry, let's begin with you. What do you understand about what happened, and particularly the role of Otto Reich?
Well, there seems to be no question that Otto Reich was had his hand in it. He was the ambassador to Venezuela for some time later in the Reagan-Bush years. Before that, he had been this head of this Office of Public Diplomacy, which was a very curious agency at the State Department. It was actually being run by the CIA, by William Casey, indirectly through the National Security Council. Casey had put one of his top propagandists over at the National Security Council, and that individual had a team which was working with Otto Reich to help spread propaganda or disinformation about what was going on in Central America. The goal was to influence the American people to see things not as they were, but what was called at the time perception management. The key goal and the understanding that this group had was that if you controlled the perceptions of the American people, that was what was truly important. If the American people thought certain things were happening in Central America then, or say now in Venezuela, that would allow the U.S. government far more flexibility to operate. So this was a behind-the-scenes operation. It was done very covertly. It involved psychological operations specialists who were brought in from Fort Bragg. They would go through cables that were coming in from Nicaragua to look for what they considered exploitable themes to somehow excite or anger the American people on certain points. And they would use exaggeration. They would plant stories in the press in the United States without identifying where they came from, and various kinds of propaganda techniques to achieve the result, which was to essentially allow the Contras to operate much more freely, even in their illegal activities like drug trafficking and so forth, but to protect those interests so the American people would not get a full understanding of what was happening in Central America. Right now, in this new incarnation, and of course he's a Cuban American. He was born in Cuba. Is very hostile to Fidel Castro and has seen Chavez as a threat because Chavez has developed really close ties to the Castro government in Cuba. So this is a continuation for Reich of kind of a personal belief and activity, as well as, in a sense, a continuation of the Cold War attitudes that Washington showed, especially during the 1980s, when the Reagan administration was going after anybody they considered a leftist.
Well, Bob, one of the things that's happened, really, is that the Bush administration, as part of its payback to the Miami Cuban community for its support in his questionable electoral victory, has turned over key posts within the administration to the most extreme right-wing Latin Americans in the country, because one of the other figures involved in this situation is the Undersecretary of Defense, Rogelio Pardo Mauer, who is the one who met with the chief of the Venezuelan military in Washington in December, and who was also, in his prior life in the 80s, was the spokesman for the Contras in the United States. He's of Costa Rican nationality, or his parents were, and he's the one who supposedly told the chief of the Venezuelan military that the United States would not support an outright coup, but of course, which it did as soon as it happened. And do you know anything about Pardo Mauer at all?
No, I don't. But obviously, it is true that the new Bush administration wanted to pay back the Cuban American community, not only for its support in Florida, which was crucial, both in getting the number of votes they got and also making sure that votes weren't counted through some of the activities in Miami. But beyond that, I think there was this idea that this was a way to pay back the conservative movement generally by giving them a hard line position in Latin America toward leftist movements again. And I think that was both an ideological step as well as a political one.
We're also joined on the phone by Greg Palast, investigative reporter who's been on Democracy Now! A number of times. His latest book is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, writes a series of columns for British newspapers, and is a correspondent for BBC Newsnight. Greg Palast, where were you this weekend as the coup happened and then was reversed?
Well, I was actually doing something which seems to have been prohibited in America, which is trying to find out the facts. So I was sitting in the Venezuelan embassy using diplomatic lines to get through to the government, which I thought had been taken over by this right-wing putsch. And in fact, I was able to reach cabinet members and leaders of the military of the elected government who were still in charge. In fact, when I reached them, it was the middle of the night at 2 a.m. London time on Saturday. They were all kind of smiling because they said, you know, literally a million people are pouring into the streets to put Chavez back. That the people had, despite the fact that the leaders of the coup were armed with automatic weapons, people unarmed broke into the White House called Miraflores, there the Venezuelan White House, and arrested. Basically, arrested and sequestered the guys who had this pretend government that they were setting up. And on the other hand, I'm hearing this, and I'm also hearing from members of the cabinet who spoke to Chavez, because after he was kidnapped and on his way and ultimately taken to a little island called Archila off the coast of Venezuela, the kidnappers allowed him to make phone calls to his daughter and some members of the cabinet. And they said he had agreed to be arrested, so-called arrested by these guys, so that they wouldn't machine gun everyone in the Venezuelan White House. He said, "I, you may arrest me, but I am still president." Now that's very interesting because the U.S. State Department and its and our official organ, the New York Times, reported as absolute fact that Chavez had resigned his presidency. And this is what permitted the Bush government and here in Britain, the Blair government, to give a kind of de facto recognition to the leaders of the coup, and certainly to declare that Chavez was no longer president. It was a complete, absolute fabrication. Chavez refused to resign, but it was crucial to the diplomatic game of saying he's out, he's gone, and we can in effect back a coup d'état.
Now, well, Greg Palast, I spoke yesterday with Chip Barkley, the spokesman for Assistant Secretary Reich, to ask him about some of this stuff, and I said to him, well, if you believed that Chavez resigned, well, then wasn't the vice president of the country, Chavez's vice president, the next in line of succession? Why did Carmona suddenly pop up? And he told me that the information that they had gotten was not only that Chavez had resigned, but that in resigning, he had fired his entire cabinet, and therefore there was no successor, and it was up to the National Assembly to then decide what was going to happen. Of course, the Carmona also dissolved the National Assembly, so that created a problem in terms of even that figment of reasoning that went on.
Carmona being the business leader who was installed as the coup president.
Now, what's disturbed me, and by the way, I write for the Guardian newspapers of Britain, their Sunday paper, The Observer, and the weekday, the Guardian. If you go on the Guardian website, you'll see my comment today. What I'm very concerned with is what seems to be a very, very effective disinformation propaganda campaign, so that the New York Times, and I have to say, even ashamedly, my own paper, The Guardian in Britain, the LA Times, the Independent of Britain, which, you know, is usually pretty good, and others, accepted right at face value that Chavez had resigned. Now, I've spoken to Chavez's people. It wasn't his style to resign. The other is that there was no evidence. I heard no resignation. I saw no resignation. And no one seemed to be actually trying to call Venezuela or get to Venezuela to find out if he had resigned. In other words, that was just part of a propaganda push, which is horrifying. It was just absolutely swallowed, accepted by the U.S. press. And even though the New York Times apologized for backing a coup and said, gee, we shouldn't have done that, they didn't apologize for the greater sin for a newspaper, which was to simply become a conduit for absolutely fabricated information. And it wasn't just And the capstone was the faux resignation, this fake out, this fake-o resignation that supposedly occurred.
Well, the important thing I think also to understand is that very often foreign correspondents, when they go into a country, immediately depend on the local press to give them information if they don't have the direct contacts themselves. And the key situation here is I was talking yesterday with Elizar Díaz-Rangel, who's the director of the largest circulation newspaper in Venezuela, Últimas Noticias, and who's actually probably one of the fairest of the newspaper of the media magnates there. But he says that the entire media of Venezuela, which is clearly is anti-Chavez, began propagating this myth of the resignation, and in fact that all the key media moguls of the country met with Carmona the night of the coup, Congressman Jose Serrano has told me that even an executive of Univision, which is the Spanish language U.S. television network, was involved in that meeting between Thursday night and Friday morning with Carmona and the coup leaders to basically develop the lines that they were going to put out to the public, so that there is a real issue here of how whether the mass media in Venezuela were direct participants in the coup, not just broadcasting misinformation, but actually part of the coup plot, including a U.S.-based broadcasting operation, which Congressman Serrano yesterday demanded of Michael Powell of the FCC an explanation as to why a U.S. corporation was involved in meetings with coup plotters in Venezuela.
Well, it's very interesting. I cite in my article an old CIA telegram from the first attempt against to overthrow Salvador Allende in 1970, and this is actually from the CIA telegram. It said, "Re-coup activities to include propaganda, black operations, disinformation, or anything else your imagination can conjure." I mean, it's amazing that they have these kind of Maxwell Smart telegrams going out, but they actually say, you know, unleash the propaganda. That's how the CIA guys talk. Except I think what's happened now is that the propaganda is not unleashed on the Latins so much as it's unleashed on the Western press. I mean, it is stunning to me. If I can find out very rapidly that that Chavez didn't resign, then my God, what happened with the New York Times? What happened with the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune? How come they were absolutely taking this this force-fed junk from the State Department?
Bob Perry, maybe what's going on now in the occupied territories is overshadowing what's happening here, and a lot of people won't even realize there was a coup and it was reversed. But is this the one of the first acts of the Iran-Contra team back in power from John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador now to the United Nations? And you could maybe talk about the significance of this. Elliot Abrams over at the National Security Agency and now Otto Reich.
Well, the Bush administration has come to see Chavez as a real thorn in their side. He's a populist. He has taken positions that have offended some of the oil industry. He has provided some discount oil to Cuba. He has taken a number of steps, which especially those folks you mentioned who were big cold warriors back in the 80s would find very offensive and that they'd want to really change. But I think the point that Greg makes is very important. The key seems to be not only to control the understanding of the people of Venezuela about this, in very much the classical CIA approach, which is to set in motion certain propaganda efforts and then have those, in a sense, dictate the results on the ground. But this idea of managing the perceptions of the American people and to some extent the Western media in general is crucial. If especially in the first 24-48 hours of an event, the U.S. government and through these kinds of means can control how people perceive something, that those perceptions pretty much solidify pretty quickly. And that's, I think, why you'd find the New York Times reporting as fact certain things they were getting from the U.S. government that aren't really challenged initially, and that becomes concrete, very difficult then to back away from. So I think we are seeing not just the effects of some of the old Cold Warriors getting back into place, but you're seeing the effects of perception management carried to more modern extremes. And essentially, this has been an effort that has been developing in the United States you can point to the sort of the mid-70s when the conservatives began to build a counter-effort, a counter-establishment, they called it, with their own media, intimidating the existing media. In the 80s, the Reagan administration joined very strongly with that, going after reporters who showed independence, trying to limit what the American people could see and understand. In the 90s, it became an effort essentially to get rid of Bill Clinton using some of the same techniques with the conservatives and the mainstream media, increasingly joining forces. And now we're in this era. There's almost no critical thinking going on in much of the American press. What the government tells them is pretty much what they accept. And it takes a while, perhaps. Sometimes you will find individual reporters on the ground in Afghanistan or in the Middle East or in Venezuela who will eventually get some facts out, as we've seen happen. But in the interim, in those key periods, often the American people are left just with what the government wants them to hear.
Well, Bob, and this is not just in the United States now, because in my discussions with this editor of the Caracas newspaper, Últimas Noticias, what he said has happened in Venezuela, and I think it's true in many countries, is that the decline of political parties as actual forces in society, because in Venezuela the old political parties are bankrupt since Chavez, has created a vacuum where the mass media themselves are now major political actors, and sure. This has happened here in the United States. And in effect, what he said was that, for instance, that the mass media, which was heavily covering the Chavez protests, as soon as thousands of Venezuelans went into the streets to demand Chavez's return, they all switched to Hollywood movies and cooking shows. Right. So that in order to keep the Venezuelan people misinformed about what was the resistance, they suddenly stopped covering the events through all day Saturday.
Well, if you watched CNN on Saturday, you would have seen almost nothing about what was happening in Venezuela.
Gives new meaning to the term "what's cooking."
and that was in part, I think, because the affiliates of CNN in Venezuela weren't providing that footage and coverage. But it was very difficult to find on Saturday the breaking story of how this dramatic set of events was unfolding. It's certainly true that there was a lot of attention on the Middle East at that time with the Powell mission, but there was this real blackout or failure to explain and to show these really remarkable scenes of people taking to the streets and a coup being reversed.
And more than 40 people killed between Friday and Saturday.
And Venezuela is an important country. It provides a lot of oil to the United States and to the world's markets. So it's not some, you know, backwater country that would be hard to get to or not being of much interest otherwise.
Fourth largest oil supplier.
So this is one that would normally be a big story. And it was certainly a big story when the first coup happened. When Chavez was removed, then it went into kind of a blackout phase as even more dramatic events unfolded over the weekend. There was, you know, some business journals, some business publications actually did some good work on it. CNN, however, did very little.
Well, we have to move to our last segment. Dr. Helen Caldicott is waiting, but I did want to ask Greg Pallas. We haven't even used the word Enron in talking about Venezuela, but could you briefly talk about the Enron-Bush-Venezuela connection?
Oh, well, I don't have all the connections to Enron, Bush, and Venezuela right now. I've been working on that story. Just one quick thing that's very important. Not only was there no coverage of, hardly any coverage of the coup, but more important, there was no coverage of Venezuela and what Chavez was doing before the coup. In other words, you'll get some coverage finally of a nation when there are cars burning in the streets of the capital. But Venezuela's been a big story. I've been screaming about this for months. In fact, I was on another radio show in the U.S. in January explicitly saying that by the end of April there will be a coup in Venezuela. And, you know, trying to get news agencies interested in this. And in the U.S., forget it. They didn't want to talk about Chavez except as they kept saying the dictator, even though this is a guy. That's a pretty funny line from the State Department. We have an unelected president, and he was elected, Chavez, by 60% of the vote. But so my big complaint, even more than the shenanigans of the Bush family in Venezuela and Enron. Enron has some type of oddly got involved in vacation properties there, and of course because of the huge gas production there, that was of big interest. They've gone big into Latin America. So I'm still trying to unravel that one. So I don't want to report it until I've investigated it.
Well,
but I think at the lack of reporting on what Chavez was doing, he was the number one dissenter from the New World Order, whereas Argentina followed the World Bank's recommendations to a letter, and the nation was destroyed economically. Chavez, by contrast, told the World Bank and the IMF and the oil companies to basically to jam it, and his country, despite a virtual siege laid on the country by American oil companies, did far better economically than any other nation in Latin America.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Greg Pallast, reporter with the BBC and The Guardian, The Observer in Britain. Bob Perry here at home. His latest book is Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, the Press, and Project Truth. When we return, Dr. Helen Caldicott. Stay with us.
Don't you know it's darkest before the dawn, and this thought keeps me moving on. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now.
Warnings. Holly Neer here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The New York Times is reporting a nuclear missile defense site could be a reality within 2 years. Pentagon officials claim they have had 4 successful tests in a row and say they're on track to open a working Star Wars site in Alaska by October 2004. Meanwhile, a Pentagon report leaked a few weeks ago revealed the Pentagon's calling for nuclear weapons labs to design new and smaller nuclear bombs that could destroy underground bunkers. The Pentagon says these mini nukes would reduce civilian casualties, but scientists say they would kill tens of thousands of civilians and that developing the new weapons would also cause a new nuclear arms race. The report also revealed the Pentagon has been ordered to draft contingency plans for using nuclear weapons against at least 7 countries, including Russia, China, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Libya, and Syria.
Well, a new book is revealing some shocking facts about Washington's willingness to press the nuclear button in the moments after the September 11th attacks. Helen Caldicott reveals in her new book the nuclear danger, that the Defense Department was dangerously close to a nuclear launch on 9/11. With the majority of the American public in the dark, the Defense Department went on DEFCON 2, its second highest alert. That means that the U.S. was ready to launch thousands of weapons within only 3 minutes decision time.
And Dr. Helen Caldicott joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Writer, physician, leading anti-nuclear activist, founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize. Her latest book is The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. So what happened on September 11th?
Well, because Russia and America still have a huge arsenal on hair trigger alert, any international situation which is tense always sets the early warning system down to its highest state of alert. So it went from DEFCON 5 down to DEFCON 2, which is the position just before George Bush gets to press the button. It's probably at a very high state of alert as we talk because of the Middle East situation and the situation in India and Pakistan, both of which are nuclear armed.
And in terms of what's been the impact in the couple of years since George Bush has been president in terms of the nuclear threat across to this country and to the rest of the world, could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, George Bush is about to violate the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which is a cornerstone of all other arms control treaties. They're about to violate the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and start testing nuclear weapons again, big ones, although they've been violating the letter and the law of the CTBT by testing small subcritical masses of plutonium in the desert underground. The labs are into designing, developing, testing and building new nuclear weapons under a program they call SSNM, Stockpile Stewardship and Maintenance. It's the second Manhattan Project being funded to a larger degree than the first Manhattan Project. No one knows that. So we're on a very dangerous foothold at the moment, and the administration is really run by Lockheed Martin. And they're formulating foreign policy. Lockheed Martin former employees populate the Bush administration and the Pentagon. They really do help to determine foreign policy. And I noticed you said the Secretary of War, Donald Rumsfeld, he's really one of them. The Heritage Foundation is right into pushing Star Wars. And as one of them recently said, Peter Teets, who is the director of the National Reconnaissance Office and is a high member of the U.S. Air Force, he said, America's going to have space dominance. We have it, we like it, and we're going to keep it. So America's about to militarize space, have orbiting probably hydrogen bombs, as mentioned 2 days ago in the New York Times, as part of its so-called missile defense, laser beam weapons, anti-satellite weapons, and they said we're going to fight war from space down to Earth and war in space. It's not politically popular at the moment, but that's what we're going to do. So these people are incredibly, extraordinarily dangerous, and they've captured the Pentagon and the White House.
And
I think that as we proceed, when the ABM is violated and we get on with Star Wars, it will provoke a massive new nuclear arms race with Russia, China, but also non-nuclear nations at the moment.
But given the reality that any credible possibility of a battle with a major nuclear power has diminished considerably, how are they able to put forth this viewpoint that we have to increase our research and development into nuclear weapons when there's no one else who's capable at this point really of opposing
the United
States?
Well, you're asking a rational question about irrational people, let's face it. Clinton only got the labs to agree with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and go along with it if he bribed them by giving them the Second Manhattan Project. That's what it is. The labs are incredibly powerful, and they have already designed and built that small bunker buster. They have already done it, the 5-kiloton bunker buster, which I think when they go into Iraq, because they say it's not if but when, they may well test it in Iraq. Now, that's half the size about of the Hiroshima bomb, and you know how many people were devastatingly killed there, 120,000. So we're moving into an area of great instability. And what worries me is that the American people do not know we're on hair trigger alert, and we came to within 10 seconds of nuclear war in 1995. They have no idea.
You know, Dr. Caldicott, it's interesting. We were just talking about Venezuela and the attempted coup there and the role of Otto Reich, now high-level official in the State Department. Well, before he got this recess appointment, he was a lobbyist for Lockheed Martin.
They all are. Amy, let's face it. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, TRW, and Raytheon run the joint. And you know, America's now spending about $400 billion a year on death. If you spent $1,000 a minute since Jesus was born, you would have got to about $1 trillion, and it's $500 billion a year on death. This is obscene when you don't even have a free healthcare system, may I say, as a physician.
You can say a lot about that
right now, in fact.
I mean, on Saturday, there's going to be a major anti-war mobilization in Washington. All sorts of groups are coming together, and they'll be protesting throughout the day. Among the issues, Colombia, military aid there, what's going on in Afghanistan, what's going on here at home. What about that trade-off?
Which trade-off?
Between what we're spending abroad on military weapons, whether it's supporting Israel and the occupied territories, or what we're not spending here at home, because the domestic agenda is hardly getting any attention.
Well, you've virtually got no domestic agenda, and that's the agenda of the Heritage Foundation. They don't believe in, quotes, big government, except on military spending for Lockheed Martin et al. And to maintain the Pentagon. When, as you said, we have no enemies, the Cold War is over, Russia would readily produce nuclear disarmament, and I'm setting up a nuclear policy research institute to go on the major media. And I know that if the American people know what's going on, we will create a massive grassroots movement as we did in the 80s and produce bilateral, multilateral nuclear disarmament or abolition and close down all the reactors in this country in 5 years. In other words, what we have to do now, Amy, is end the nuclear age.
Do you think that the hope of this renewed military-industrial complex is to provoke China into an arms race, because that's the only country that could really afford an arms race at this point?
Well, they can't really, because they've got 1.3 billion people to feed and educate and employ and the like. But yes, that's exactly what the Pentagon's doing. They've written long articles and papers about this, quite studious. They're now ringing China with bases in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Georgia. South Korea is being militarized. Japan is encouraged to violate its non-aggressive constitution. Taiwan's being militarized. And Australia's playing a vital role. We've got about 34 US bases there, including the biggest CIA base in the world, which is an integral part of taking on China. So China is now the new Cold War enemy, and the European theater is being moved as we speak to the Asian Pacific theater. So what's going on is very profound, and what worries me is that no one really knows about it.
Dr. Caldicott.
Except the Pentagon.
Since September 11th, the concern about nuclear power plants being the site of terrorist attacks, mm-hmm. do you think that has fueled a new anti-nuclear movement, the concern about these sitting basically nuclear bombs?
Certainly has, definitely in Westchester County and hopefully in Manhattan. Because if Indian Point blows because of a plane flying in it or a terrorist disrupting its cooling system or its electricity system, you'll all be, and the wind's blowing in your direction, which it tends to do, you'll all be trapped. You'll never get out of New York. And when we talk about the World Trade Towers, that was nothing compared to what will happen if Indian Point blows. All you'll taste is a funny metallic taste in your mouth, but within 2 or 3 days, your hair will be falling out. You'll be vomiting and bleeding to death with acute radiation illness. And those who do not die, there'll be an epidemic of leukemia 5 years later, and hundreds of thousands of people, if not more, will die of cancer in the years ahead.
Well, the amazing thing is that in Westchester County, it has sparked an enormously broad movement. Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, everyone is really worried about the situation with Indian Point, and it may actually provide, if enough information gets out about this threat, it may provide the basis for a new, a much realignment of forces among the American people.
Yeah, well, see, it's not Republican nor Democrat. We're talking about preventive medicine here, so it's not political at all. And everyone should read my book, Nuclear Madness, which talks about the new passively safe nuclear reactors that Cheney wants to build after talking with Enron. 400 of them, they're not passively safe, and you want 400 new nuclear power plants in a country that's scared stiff of terrorism. I mean, this administration, you'd have to say, needs therapeutic intervention for the public health of the people of this country, let alone the planet.
Well, Dr. Caldicott, I want to thank you very much for being with us. How do you keep up your hope? You've been doing this for decades
I
now.
Must admit,
you went
back
to Australia for a period. You ran for parliament there.
Yeah.
And you're back again writing The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex.
Well,
just fill in the back book, the blank back to Reagan. You've been writing these books for 20 years.
Well, look, I'm a pediatrician. I took the Hippocratic Oath, and I'm damned if I'm going to die before we end the nuclear age. We nearly did it in the 80s. We ended the Cold War, all of us, with Gorbachev. But Clinton didn't get rid of the weapons. That's his legacy. It's not the blue dress. It's that he didn't get rid of the weapons. And now we have to finish our work. And I believe that American people will rise up if they know what's going on, as they did in the 80s. The churches, the Catholic Church needs a bit of redemption now, so maybe they can get into this as they did in the 80s. And I think we can certainly end it. I believe in the goodness of people. I see it so often. And I know the American people really want to do the right thing, which is save the world.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, The New Nuclear Danger. And that does it for today's program. You can order a cassette copy of the show by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Salone is our engineer and music maestro. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org, mail@democracynow.org. From downtown community television, blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!